Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. Author Mark Mason joins me in the studio today for our weekly book review. We'll begin with Francesca Kay's latest novel, The Long Room, which explores surveillance and human interest in other beings. We'll discover the trial Emile Zola had to go through to get his work published in the late 19th century England in Zola and the Victorians, Censorship in the Age of Hypocrisy. And we'll hop on our bikes for a tour around the UK's capital. And for a little bit of history on deliveries, we'll open What Goes Around, a London cycle courier's story by Emily Chappell. That's all coming up on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Welcome to the show, Mark. Let's begin today with your fiction choice, a new novel here by Francesca Kay called The Long Room. Now, on the surface, this could be mistaken for a spy novel, but it really delves into human behaviour and imagination. Mark, tell us what's happening in the plot of this book.
What's happening is a guy called Stephen Donaldson is a listener at one of the British Secret Services in 1981. And it's his job, of course, back in those days, surveillance was a lot less sophisticated than it is now technologically. And it was a case of conversations being recorded. Either they would secrete microphones in a flat when they were spying on somebody and record 12 hours of conversation at a time. And it was Stephen and lots of other people's jobs. They all work in this long room, the long room of the title, to listen through to it and to pick up on anything of note. And also to record directly from telephone lines as well. You couldn't, you know, now the CIA and the British Secret Services have software that does the listening for them and picks up certain key words that are to do with terrorism or whatever. But back in those days, it was a case of listening to it all in real time in, you know, old-fashioned reel-to-reel tape recorders. And so it's very atmospheric from that point of view. It takes you back to your, if you're old enough like me to remember that time, it takes you back to your childhood when these sort of things existed. And it kept reminding me of the film One Hour Photo. I don't know if you remember Robin Williams.
Yes, of course. Playing against type in that rather creepy role.
Yes, very creepy. From about, I guess, 2002, something like that.
Yeah.
And he played, for people who don't know the film, he played a guy that worked in a photo developing. Again, remember those, you know, those incredible days
when you
had to go and get your photos on film developed.
Dare we say the good old days.
The good old days. Well, some people still do it. Some people will tell you that digital doesn't.
Enthusiasts, of course. They keep everything alive.
Who spend a lot of money on their equipment now. But he used to work there, and he worked in this place and got obsessed with this woman who used to bring her photos in every week. And, you know, she got a young child and a husband. And he got obsessed with the family and sort of fell in love with a woman in a way and knew what was happening in the family because he developed their photos. And in the same way, Stephen Donaldson gets obsessed with the wife of one of the guys that he's listening to.
So one might assume that the way that this is depicted in the old-fashioned sort of form, does that make it a little bit more exciting?
It does. It's great. The fact that it's 1981 very specifically is important for two reasons. First of all, the one I mentioned, that, you know, the old technology, and it's just that astonishing fact to us now that that's what you had to do in those days. But secondly, because of the time, 1981 in this country and in America, in lots of governments in the Western world, was a time of huge change. Thatcher in the UK, Reagan in the States, a lot of other governments were having to go through not just the Cold War internationally, you know, East v. West, but also there were threats from the unions internally in this country. And in the States as well, big union versus government battles and union versus employer battles. So it's a very dramatic time. And it's set in December 1981, the run-up to Christmas. And so the days are dark and the night, you know, the days are very short. And it's a very dark novel in both senses, literally. And that helps it to be dark metaphorically as well. So it's very dramatic. And the story, the reason I very rarely do books, novels on this programme is it's very hard to talk about a novel without giving away too much of the plot. But, you know, it very quickly becomes clear that Stephen's obsessed with this woman and sort of wants to try and follow her and physically get to meet her.
And what about the themes that it's picking up on here? Because one might imagine that despite the fact that it is set in the past, it is picking up on all of those sorts of worries about surveillance that are running so rife in our society today with, as you touched upon, so many new opportunities for the way in which we can spy on people and perform surveillance. Yeah. Do you think that there are any parallels that are quite clearly being drawn here?
Well, in terms of, I mean, what I loved about this is that I don't really like spy novels, but it's the personal aspect of this that I really liked. So it doesn't, it doesn't go into that too much. It's the notion of this personal individual story of his relationship with the woman, or the relationship he wants to have with the woman, in the same way that Robin Williams is sort of deluded about having a relationship with his family in One Hour Photo. So it picks up on that. But yeah, it does make you think, you know, that was what they had to do in those days. That was, by they, I mean the Secret Services. That was something on the side. If you're worried about the surveillance state, that was one thing we had on our side in those days, that the government physically couldn't do that much. Whereas now, yeah, if you're worried about what's happening in this novel in terms of people being spied on, it is thousands of times worse now with what they can do technologically.
The Long Room by Francesca Kay is out now, published by Faber and Faber. Well, let's look now at a book that explores censorship in the late 1800s here in the UK. Zola and the Victorians, Censorship in the Age of Hypocrisy, looks at the battles for the publication of books revolving around highly shocking and transgressive themes by French writer Emile Zola. Mark, firstly, what was so controversial about Zola's books?
Well, it was one particular book, The Soil, that this book is really about Zola's English publisher, who, of course, as well as publishing them, had to translate them from French into English, about his publisher, Henri Vizetelly. I hope I've pronounced that right. It's Vizetelly. And he has published several of Zola's books. And as usual with great controversies about, you know, unworthy material and material that might corrupt and the people who want to protect us from dangerous books, it just blows up out of nothing. There are certain factors. There's a journalist called W.T. Stead who edits a London newspaper, and he decides he's going to make this a cause. And the National Vigilance Association, now there's a name that's to strike terror into anybody. You know, they're the sort of Mary Whitehouse was the equivalent in modern times in Britain, and there are all sorts of equivalents in the States and around the world. Of people who just decide that they know what's best for people to read. And they pick up on some of the sexual content in Zola's books. Of course, you know, very, very mild. They were not pornography. And the book's great at bringing out the hypocrisies involved here, that this happens in 1888, the same year that Jack the Ripper is doing his murders in London. And the newspapers, the same newspapers that are campaigning against this filth from this disgusting Frenchman Zola coming over here to corrupt our English readers, they're reporting the Jack the Ripper murders of prostitutes in the East End with pornographic relish, you know, the details of these women and what they did for a job and how they were murdered. So there's that hypocrisy. There's also the inconsistency that if Zola is filthy for talking about, you know, sexual relationships in France, in rural France, the sort of references he makes are there in Shakespeare, in Byron, in most of the great poetry, you know, for thousands of years past. And they just pick up on this because it's modern. And there's a scene where a girl is dealing with a bull. She's preparing it to mount a cow so that it can impregnate a cow on the farm. And there's all sorts of symbolism. So it's the sort of stuff that when you take it out of context in a courtroom, and this does end up in a courtroom, this ends up with Vizetelly going to prison and his health at the age of 70 being ruined by his spell in prison. You can, of course, make it seem disgusting, and a barrister can do anything they want with it in court. But there's lots of parallels with modern cases.
I would imagine so, because just from what you've told me there, it does sort of sound like it's pointing out that when we talk about hypocrisy in the context of censorship, or really in any sort of political context, it is quite easy to see that that is not a phenomenon that is that's specific to modern times. Take us back 100-odd years and it was basically exactly the same.
Absolutely. And one of the points that they make, one of the campaigners involved says he hasn't read this filth, his words, he hasn't read it himself, but he has received a summary of its content. You know, it's always the way. And the other point that a lot of the puritanical campaigners who are trying to get these works banned, the point they make is that, of course, we read it. We're intelligent people. We can read it without being corrupted. But we're just worried about the poor, unintelligent working classes. You know, they wouldn't be able to. That very patronising way they have of assuming that they know what's best.
It's incredible, because that's exactly the same argument that is used today for, especially in film classification boards. What you just said then was exactly the argument that was put forward a number of years ago by the Australian Film Classification Board when the film Mysterious Skin was looking for a release in Australia. It was very nearly banned.
Right.
It's quite incredible to
to see that those same arguments were used just a few, well, some hundred years ago, just to change a few names and a few identities, and you've got something that's precisely the same. So this takes evidence from letters, manuscripts, and journals. But how does the author here structure the book? Because there's so much to cover. Does it come together into some sort of coherent narrative?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's done chronologically from the start of the first case through. There were two cases. He's in the first case, Vitelli doesn't get sent to prison. He's fined £100 in 1888. That was a lot of money back then. And then there's a second case where he does actually end up going to prison. So the narrative is told. But what I love about the way the author's done it is there's a certain amount of artistic license in there, in that she has imagined, you know, at some point she'll say, so-and-so walked into the room and flicked a speck of dust off the sleeve of his coat or something like that. You know, she couldn't possibly know that that happened, of course, but the facts, everything that's factual in there is true. She's just imagined certain scenes and heightened them slightly. So she hasn't made anything up. She's just said, so-and-so has a meeting and he walks in, it's a rainy day and he's, you know, his shoes are wet. And just those little details that make it almost like a novel. You know, none of those made-up details are important in the sense that they don't say anything that's crucially untrue at any point.
But they just are important to create some sort of fully founded character.
Or atmosphere, yeah. Faction, they sometimes call it. You know, faction. A mix between fact and fiction. And it's I love the way she's done it. It's a gripping story to start with, and she's told it really well.
Well, Zola and the Victorians, Censorship in the Age of Hypocrisy by Eileen Horne is out now, published by MacLeod's Press. Finally, today we'll end with a two-wheeled journey around the UK's capital in What Goes Around, a London Cycle Courier's story. This is written by Emily Chappell, who never meant to be a cycle courier, but 6 years after starting, she's never looked back. Well, Mark, what story is Emily telling here?
She's telling her own story and the story of couriers in general. I like the way she mixed the two. She is a woman who's, I think, probably in her late 20s now by the sounds of it. She was always a keen cyclist, and she points out the little details, like cyclists, certainly couriers, as well as being obsessed with their bikes, tend also to be coffee snobs. And there's one particular coffee shop in a certain part of London that they go because it has fantastic coffee and you can get your bike fixed there as well. So little things like that.
There are a lot of them popping up all over the world
really?
At the moment, actually. Yeah, it's the new niche.
Mixing coffee and bikes.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. It's if you live in a neighbourhood that has a coffee shop that also fixes your bike, it means your real estate values are on the up. Good news.
Well, she was probably one of the first. It's well known. There's a particular pub as well, which has since closed down, that all the couriers go to. And it's a really fascinating little community of the couriers that have been there for a long time, who can actually hack it, who can make a living. You'll never make a brilliant living, but they can make a bit of a living. And all the truths she discovers, for instance, Thursday is the real killer. She says on Friday, it's infused with the adrenaline of everyone else's last-minute deadlines. So that's how you get through Friday, but Thursday's the real killer. All the beautiful little tips about, like, how to keep warm on a really cold day. She goes to a particular supermarket in London that has a rotisserie oven where they do the chickens, where you can buy ready-cooked chickens. So she goes and stands there, and there are various heating vents as well at the backs of certain buildings. And where to keep the key for your bike lock. She keeps it on an elasticated hairband around her wrist so that it's always there. She can just pull it away from her wrist and unlock the bike and lock it back up without having to ferret in a pocket for a key the whole time. And how it gradually becomes part of your identity. You know, she's one of the conscientious ones that does turn down her radio whenever she goes into a reception. And she finds herself, it becomes such a habit that whenever she walks into a reception of a building, she reaches to her upper arm to turn down the volume, that she finds herself doing it on the weekends when she's not working. She's just going to the cinema.
Oh,
she hasn't got her radio on. She finds herself doing it. And with a book like this, you need to like the narrator. You need to think, yeah, if I was doing that job, that's how I try and behave. You know,
I was just thinking that, actually. It is very dependent on the voice that's telling the story. How did she come across as a writer to you?
She's a fantastic writer. I mean, yeah, two different things. She's obviously a very nice person. She talks about her regular clients. She always makes a point of writing their name into the little XDA. I hope I pronounced that right, or XDA. It's a capital X, then DA. For some reason, that's the name of the little computer screen that a courier gives you when you have to sign for something.
Oh, I see. And
with those stylus pens that never look anything like your signature because they're always half a second behind what you're doing on the screen. she always makes a point of typing their name into the XDA before she gives it to them to show that she's remembered the name. She's always polite. Like I say, she turns the radio down. She's obviously a very, you know, personable, nice human being, because she points out that a lot of the couriers aren't. They can be quite chippy, some of them. So that's the first thing. You like her for a start and you trust her. But then also some of the writing is just fantastic. She's, I mean, with London as a character in the novel, you couldn't have written this sort of book about a courier.
Wise choice to turn a city like London into a character in your book.
She's brilliant because, the city is brilliant and that makes for brilliant writing. There's so much more to write about because it's such a dramatic, diverse city. She calls London Bridge a doleful conveyor belt shoveling commuters into the furnace of the city. She says that for anyone who knows London, they know Holborn Viaduct. There are four statues on this viaduct, which is, you know, a long distance above the street that runs beneath it. And one of them is of the statue of Commerce. It's a female figure, a classical figure, cloaked in a robe. And it represents commerce. And the hand of this statue is reaching out over the side of the viaduct. And Emily Chappell's way of putting it is that the statue reached out into the void above Farringdon as if she had just cast a handful of coins down into the river of traffic below. She's got a brilliant turn of phrase. It makes you want to carry on reading.
Well, it is frighteningly cold here in London at the moment, so you may not want to jump on a bike yourself, but you can live it vicariously through Emily Chappell and her book What Goes Around, a London Cycle Courier's Story, published by Faber and Faber. And that does bring us to the end of today's show. Special thanks to my guest today, Mark Mason. You've been listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow for our film review with Tim Robey. But for now, it's goodbye from me, and thanks for listening.